This is the kind of analysis that we need much more of, as particularly as we move into tighter fiscal times.
A state report questions whether oil tax credits are a good investment for Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, J-Bear soldiers at a training in Australia react to the Army plan to cut most of their brigade.
The ultimate goal for us was to move to Alaska and retire. And now, with the close down, it's going to affect our decisions drastically.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Are North Slope oil tax credits a good investment for the state of Alaska? That's the question asked by a recent report from the Department of Revenue. The researchers answer, no, not compared to other options. But some experts say the paper doesn't give the tax credits a fair shake. KSKA's Anne Hillman has more.
From 2009 to 2014, the state paid out $4 billion in tax credits to oil companies. The undated paper from researchers at the Department of Revenue asks a simple question. What if we hadn't? What if we had invested that money in the Constitutional Budget Reserve instead? Their answer, even if all new oil production from 2011 to 2024 is attributed to those credits, the state would still make more money if they put that $4 billion into the CBR instead. The paper says the state subsidized every barrel of oil produced from 2009 to 2014 by at least $11. The researchers conclude the reward for investing in oil tax credits is not worth the risk. The authors of the paper, Lauren Crawford, Tim Harper, and John Chotsky, are with DOR's Economic Research Group and were not allowed to speak about their work. But two other experts were willing to offer their thoughts. Retired UAA professor of economics Scott Goldsmith says the paper has flaws. He likens it to an examination from 30,000 feet. But he says the idea behind it, weighing the opportunity costs of spending, is very useful.
This is the kind of analysis that we need much more of. As particularly as we move into tighter fiscal times, we need to be looking at what the return is on the money that our government is spending.
Goldsmith says it would be better to divide the credits out by type to see which is the most effective. He says the credits should also be analyzed for their impact on the overall economy, like job creation.
Because the health of the overall economy is an important public policy objective of the state as well as balancing its budget.
Economist and former deputy director of the Department of Revenue, Larry Persily, says ultimately, all tax credits are like rolling the dice. You never know if they'll have great returns or not. He says the paper doesn't go deep enough to definitively conclude that oil tax credits are a bad investment.
This report raises some good questions, poses some hypotheticals. I just don't think it's complete and comprehensive enough to answer the question. So people shouldn't look at this report and says, oh, that gives me the black and white answer. This just gives me another shade of gray.
Persily says one major problem is the length of time of the comparison. The paper says that in the best case scenario, the state would only bring in $2.6 billion in new revenue because of the credits. But that's only over 10 years.
It's a little unfair in that it doesn't look at the lifetime of new fields, if there are new fields, if the new fields develop and produce oil for 20 or 30 years. Certainly that is conjecture, but to be fair, I think you've got to look at a longer period of time than this report looks at.
Persily says another flaw is using the Constitutional Budget Reserve as a comparison tool. That fund is scheduled to run out of money in the next couple of years. Adding in the $4 billion spent on oil tax credits would only extend the CBR's life for a year or less. Ken Alper is the Department of Revenue's tax director, the division that developed the research paper. He says the analysis is just one of many different tools his division is using to evaluate the effectiveness of tax credits, and possible alternatives to them.
Is there a benefit from the state instead of giving credits, lending money directly ourselves, or even taking an ownership stake in an oil and gas fields? These are sort of options that are on the table and things that we're looking at. And that particular paper is just one of several pieces of research that we're using to try to inform policy discussion and possibly a new direction for this administration.
The paper is marked final and was released through an information request submitted by KSKA. But Alper says he views it as a draft and plans to release a different version at a later date. He says he disagrees with some of the final numbers in this paper because it includes qualified capital expenditure credits, which he says aren't really credits. Excluding those would change the results by hundreds of millions of dollars. But separating the QCEs from the others is a difficult, lengthy process. Though Alper disagrees with parts of the paper, he says the oil tax credit system does need to change.
There's a general recognition that the system, as it is now, is probably unsustainable simply because we can't afford it.
Last week, Governor Bill Walker delayed the payment of $200 million in oil tax credits, in part to spur discussion of the issue. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Yesterday came news the Army will be cutting thousands of positions from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, with the majority expected to come from the 425th Airborne Brigade. But hundreds of troops from the unit are currently in Australia on a training mission. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes is embedded with those troops. He reports many only heard about the cuts over social media or from family.
Specialist Jesse Reed hasn't really been keeping up with the news. After 19 hours flying from J-Bear, he jumped into a remote corner of eastern Australia near Shoalwater Bay as part of Operation Talisman Sabre, a training mission. After spending the night in the field, literally a field next to an airstrip, he learned about the cuts Thursday afternoon.
Just got a text message from my friend leading me to a news article talking about the cuts for U.S. Army Alaska.
Reed's been at J-Bear for 2.5 years, and though disappointed, he says this isn't the end of the world for him.
Not out of a job tomorrow. I'd finish out time here and then do my reenlistment and go wherever the Army chooses to go or the Army sends me.
By the time all 2,600 positions are cut in 2017, the brigade will be left with just under 1,000 personnel. But according to Captain Chase Spears, a veteran of the 425th assigned to U.S. Army Alaska, the reductions won't happen overnight.
No one is showing up and being told, hey, your position has gone away. It doesn't work that way.
In a drawdown, the Army tries to eliminate positions through attrition, leaving slots unfilled after soldiers move on to new postings. But some soldiers will likely have to be let go through what are called involuntary separations to hit target goals over the next 2 years. By then, according to a Pentagon press conference Thursday, the brigade will be reconfigured as a battalion-sized task force. They'll still be the only Army unit that's able to do airborne operations in the Arctic, along with partner missions in the Pacific like this one, Talisman Sabre, but not at the level that they can currently. Even with some unknowns, the cuts will hurt soldiers who have put down roots in Alaska and can't easily head on to new postings, like Sergeant First Class Frank Petita, who heard the news in the gym. When Petita moved from North Carolina with his family, they saw appreciating home values and a community filled with military retirees in Wasilla.
I wanted my family and my kids to enjoy Alaska, and I think that's best done off post, and so we decided to buy a house.
According to the Army's studies on economic impacts, a cut this size means a drop of $358 million from Anchorage's economy. Part of that loss is salaries going away for soldiers like Petita, who are further along in their careers and more likely to own property.
The guys that have the equivalent rank of myself, that I would say the vast majority own houses, and I'm talking 70-80% easy.
One such guy is sitting a few feet away, Staff Sergeant Josh Schneiderman, who moved to Eagle River specifically for the good schools.
We're extremely worried, especially now. I mean, I'm very close to retirement, and this drives a lot of things, because the ultimate goal for us was to move to Alaska and retire. And now, with the close down, it's going to affect our decisions drastically.
Now that worries from the last few months over whether or not cuts would come to J-Bear have been answered, Schneiderman says there's a whole new set of concerns once he gets back to Alaska.
I'm going to go home now, and my wife's probably going to inform me of the closure that everybody's aware of. However, what am I supposed to tell her? We'll figure it out. I mean, it's hard because you don't know who's going and you don't know who's staying.
But before anything else, this airborne battalion from 425 has one more day in Australia, a 19-hour plane ride, and another parachute jump back onto base. In Brisbane, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, First Lady Michelle Obama addresses Alaska Native and American Indian youth at the White House.
Your offspring will look back at all of you and say that you were the generation who started it all.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Experts say this year's Bristol Bay sockeye harvest will be less than half the record-breaking boom recorded last year. The Alaska Journal of Commerce reports commercial harvest forecasts put the catch this year at 37.6 million fish. As the season's halfway point passed, that number fell by more than 17 million sockeye. Experts are saying a late run is unlikely. The 20-year average for caught sockeye salmon is at 23.5 million, with 41 million caught last year. McDowell Group Fisheries economist Andy Wink says this year's slump could help unload canned and frozen inventory left over from last year. It's unclear how this will impact prices. The candidate to be the state university system's next president is meeting with students, faculty, and community members around the state this week. KTOO's Jeremy Shea caught up with Jim Johnson in Juneau earlier this week.
Jim Johnson has a professional background in organized labor, academia, and most recently in corporate business as a senior manager for Alaska Communications and Doi Unlimited, the Alaska Native Corporation for the Interior. In June, the University of Alaska Board of Regents selected him as its single finalist to lead the system. The candidate is tall, energetic, and quick with a smile. If he gets the job, he says students and faculty can expect him to be present on campuses around the state, listening and sharing ideas for how to strengthen the university in tough fiscal times. Here's how Johnson describes the job.
In large part, to be the voice of the university for the state. Okay, to represent the university in the legislature, to represent the university with the governor and the governor's staff. So there's an external side of things with big corporations and other NGOs and organizations, Congress, etc. So that's the outside piece. The inside piece is to make sure that the university is organized in a way that's, that delivers the best and widest access to students using technology, etc. Delivers high-quality academic programs cost-effectively.
He highlighted two areas he wants to work on, remedial education and Arctic research. He says over half of the university system students require remedial education, a major challenge. His ambition for the university system as an Arctic research center is to be the best.
Alaska and right now has the number one research university in the world when it comes to Arctic research. We've got to keep that, and we've got to, in fact, grow that, because over the next 10, 20, 30 years, there's going to be a lot of action in the north, and I think we want to position ourselves to continue to be leading in the study of and the understanding of that very, very important part of the world.
Courtney Enright was the board's student regent during the main selection process.
What I really was looking for was someone who focused on students or understood that students have an important role in the university. So somebody that has that understanding and that connection of students as a customer effectively for the university.
Enright graduated in May and spoke from Louisiana, where she's beginning a new job. She said Johnson was an exemplary candidate. She suggested students keep an eye on tuition rates as one gauge of his performance.
The president does submit formally the tuition recommendation every year to the Board of Regents. That's one of the biggest measures students really look at. But given the fiscal challenges of the university, it's a little bit more, I think, complicated these years than to just judge based on that number.
The regents are expected to finalize their selection at the end of the month. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
For the hundreds of sex offenders in Alaska's prisons, Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau is the only facility to offer treatment. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, the intensive program forces inmates to face and confront their crimes.
Andrew Peabody has served about 27 years in prison for sexual assault. He said he's scheduled to be released in February. Peabody said he used to feel numb and didn't want to deal with what he'd done. During an event at Lemon Creek Correctional Center earlier this year, Peabody said the sex offender treatment program is teaching him empathy.
For my victim, you know, because you have to write a letter to that person. realizing what you become to that person, how you affected that person's life.
The letters aren't actually sent. Licensed clinical counselor Malcolm Nichols created and runs the sex offender treatment program at the Juneau Prison. Nichols has a history of working with high-risk populations. Prior to Lemon Creek, he ran a sex offender treatment program in Columbus, Ohio. The two-year program is a combination of structured group therapy and individual counseling. Some inmates are also prescribed medication for sexual urges. Nichols says the program is not supposed to be a cure. The goal is for inmates to learn to control and manage risk factors that could lead to sexual assaults. Another assignment is writing a narrative describing the period of time leading up to their crime.
It starts a year out from their sexual crime, and then takes them 9 months, 6 months, 3 months, and then 24 hours before it happened. And this can be very difficult and dramatic.
It's supposed to be self-revealing. Nichols doesn't let inmates get away with denying or minimizing what they've done. These are tactics, he says, to avoid change. Nichols recounted what happened when one inmate described his offense during a recent group session.
He was telling it from, of course, from his own personal position, but I always want them to also give the objective, you know, what actually happened, which he didn't. So when I confronted him, he sort of got extremely dysphoric and broke into some deep sobbing. And this kind of, the whole group was like, you could hear a pin drop.
The Lemon Creek Correctional Center program treats 24 men at a time. Inmates enter the program when they're within 3 years of being released. All have been convicted of at least one sex assault and have admitted to at least one. Nichols says some have a history of committing many sexual assaults. One even claimed to have committed hundreds.
Some of the higher-risk guys have a history of sex offending going way back, you know, into their adolescence or even childhood.
Alaska leads the country for the rate of reported forcible rape, according to FBI crime statistics. There are about 770 sex offenders in the Alaska prison system, which Nichols says represents a fraction of total offenders. He says it takes a lot of patience to work with sex offenders.
I don't see people as necessarily the sum of their parts. I think that people are capable of choice and that I have to not sort of shame them or sort of ostracize them or let them think that they're not human or they're incapable of change.
The work takes its toll. When Nichols leaves the office, he tries to completely disengage with work. To avoid stress, he bikes and exercises regularly. And there's a lot at stake when inmates leave the treatment program and are released into the community.
We all in this field live in dread of one of our guys getting out and committing some kind of horrendous sexual offense. And I've had some extremely dangerous inmates who, as they were leaving the program, you know, I was like keeping my fingers crossed.
So far, of the 52 who've completed the program and been released, one is back in prison for a sexual offense. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
About 30 Alaskans in their teens and 20s were in Washington, D.C. today to participate in the first ever White House Tribal Youth Gathering. The highlight for many was a passionate speech by First Lady Michelle Obama. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
In a cavernous hotel ballroom near the White House, Mrs. Obama told the crowd they, as individuals, matter.
And each of you was put on this earth for a reason. Each of you has something that you're destined to do, whether that's raising a beautiful family, whether that's succeeding in a profession or leading your community into a better future. You all have a role to play. And we need you.
Obama urged them to notice the investment placed in them. She also said, despite how they may feel at low points, they are never alone.
Everyone in this room has your back. Everyone who's speaking at this summit, all those cabinet secretaries, all those powerful people who have come here for you, they have your back. And you definitely have a president and a first lady who have your back.
The gathering is part of President Obama's Gen I, or Generation Indigenous Project, aimed at cultivating leadership in young people and helping them succeed. The participants, more than 1,000, had to apply for selection, so this is a high-achieving bunch. Many of them have already launched projects to improve their communities. In her speech, the First Lady warned attendees that some of the big changes they're seeking may not occur until their children or grandchildren are grown.
And see, decades from now, maybe those kids, your offspring, will look back at all of you and say that you were the generation who started it all. Gen I, you were the generation that dug deep. You were the generation that drew strength from your history and wrote a new story of Indian country and of America.
Among those seeking big changes is Megan Topcock of Nome, who has roots in Ambler and Mary's Igloo.
My to-do list is very long. I'm really concerned about subsistence hunting and shipping that's increasing through the Bering Strait, as well as the erosion of the land, because my aunt is from Shishmaref, and so it's a big issue.
She's a law student at the University of Oregon, and at 24, one of the older attendees at the gathering. She spoke after a session on environment and climate change.
I think what's really inspiring is that our youth are engaging in these issues, because I think so often, especially out in the village, like where I'm from, there's kind of a lack of awareness or a passivity about it. And these kids are really inspiring because they're doing things in their communities and bringing those ideas here with them and sharing them. So we're all learning from each other and we can take those ideas back, and it's like a ripple effect.
Some of the Alaskans wore fur vests and calico cuspucks that made them easy to identify. 21-year-old Elizabeth Ferguson really stood out. She wore a tall crown made of jade and ivory. It's her tiara for winning Miss Arctic Circle, a regional culture pageant. She was also wearing a sash across her torso with Miss Arctic Circle spelled out in sealskin.
I'm from Kotzebue, Alaska. I'm the youngest tribal council member on our native village of Kotzebue.
Ferguson says she drew inspiration from other leaders at the conference, but she says the First Lady's speech really hit the mark.
Not only did she just speak to us and encourage us and empower us, she didn't speak down on us, you know, like she's superior. She spoke at us, she met us at our level, and she lifted us up.
In conjunction with the conference, the White House also announced a raft of grants and programs to improve Indian education, justice, and economic opportunity. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Big white plastic bags called super sacks line a beach on Montague Island in Prince William Sound. The sacks are filled with marine debris like fishing nets, water bottles, and styrofoam. This summer, a team from Gulf of Alaska Keeper has spent 50 days collecting debris on Montague Island as part of a multi-year effort. APRN intern Noelia Gonzalez has the story.
The trash that accumulates on the shoreline of Montague Island from one day to another is only the tip of the iceberg. There's more where it came from, and it will keep coming back. It has been like this for decades.
What I'm getting at is what you see on the beach is a fraction of what's out there, either being it floating on the surface or sunk on the bottom of the water.
Ryan Pallister has spent 10 years working for the nonprofit Gulf of Alaska Keeper. The GOAK crew goes all the way down the shorelines of South Central Alaska, from Kodiak to Kayak Island. Pallister says the weather can be extreme. The team also has to keep a close watch for brown bears. And then there's the challenge of the work itself.
Yeah, basically it comes down to just human muscle. I mean, we use chainsaws and knives. And the heli, of course. Now that we have the heli, we can use the heli to pull and lift a little bit, but Yeah, it comes down to just man hours, really.
The 10-person crew received help from volunteers like Hanako Yokoda, who works with the Japan Environmental Action Network. Yokoda has a very special duty, recognizing the marine debris from Japan that may be from the 2011 tsunami that swept millions of tons of debris into the ocean. She points at the mass of trash next to her.
You know, with these stuff, I can never say that it is from Japan. I mean, it is from Japan, but I can't never say like it is from tsunami, because it doesn't really state that it's from tsunami.
However, Yokoda can read Japanese, and she's able to recognize the logos and names some fishermen write on their buoys to distinguish them. Although she now lives in Vancouver, when Yokoda visits Japan, fishermen ask her to bring their buoys back if she finds them.
It would be very interesting if I get to like actually take something back and return it.
The marine debris that ends up in the beaches of Montague come from remote places like Japan, but also from Russia, China, Korea, Vietnam, and Malaysia, Yokoda says.
It really doesn't matter where it comes from. Like, we all just have to clean it up.
You know, the more we collect and the more we contain, the more gets off this island and gets recycled.
Crew member Scott Groves is standing next to a few super sacks of trash, and he seems satisfied. They have reached their goal of around 20 to 25 super sacks a day. He writes the numbers down in his notebook.
As far as numbers are concerned, you like kind of forget how much you actually do out here. And it's like every day you still get your mind blown on how much garbage is actually on these beaches.
Ryan Pallister says that after a decade cleaning the coast, he's still surprised by the amount of marine debris.
Out here, it's dirty forever. And it almost is hard to fathom finishing it in my lifetime, but more people would help. More resources.
So why keep coming back to clean something that will be dirty tomorrow? Pallister has a simple answer.
If your neighbor was throwing trash in your yard, should you clean it up or say something to him? Most likely. It's kind of the same situation.
Pallister believes a change in people's behavior is needed to stop the contamination problem, but he's not very optimistic about it. In the meantime, the helicopter will come down soon to collect the bags of trash and sling them onto a barge. With help from Hannah Craig, I'm Noelia Gonzalez in Anchorage.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of the stories tonight, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Australia, Jeremy Shea and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Noelia Gonzalez from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.